to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
In her book, Big Box Swindle, author and researcher Stacy Mitchell reveals how mega retailers are creating many of our country's most pressing problems. Stacy Mitchell, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I introduced you as a researcher. What's the nature of the research that you do?
Well, I work for a national nonprofit research and educational organization called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and our mission really is to look at how to strengthen communities and local economies and really the value of locally owned businesses, local farms, local enterprise, and how that really nurtures community and nurtures our economy and why that's important.
Well, the title of your book, Big Box Swindle, and the True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses, The True Cost of Mega Retailers. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I found, I've been working on this issue and traveling across the country and working with communities that are sort of struggling with this kind of development. And what I have found in all of that research is that these companies, Walmart, Target, Home Depot, we think that they bring prosperity, that they bring jobs and economic growth, but in fact, there's a huge hidden cost. And when you look at it closely, they actually take far more out of our local economies than they put back in. They take out more jobs than they actually create. They take out more public revenue than they contribute in tax revenue. They really undermine local economic development in a number of ways. And they also have really come with big environmental and social costs as well. And when you begin to look at that whole picture, what I have found is that this is not such a good deal. I mean, this is the swindle, right, of big box retailers.
Yeah, so when you say big box swindle, who's getting swindled?
We are, all of us. Whether you shop there or not, we are all paying a price for these stores.
Because I could say, well, I don't shop the big box stores, but I'm being swindled.
Absolutely. One of the things, you know, that these companies are always coming and saying, oh, we have low prices, you know. But the problem is that if you look at the rise of these retailers, they are actually destroying jobs and opportunities and lowering our incomes much faster than they're lowering prices. Over the last 20 years or so, the American middle class has actually been shrinking. And meanwhile, we have growing numbers of families that belong to the ranks of the working poor, people who work full-time but simply cannot meet even basic living expenses. And the argument that I make in the book is that one of the reasons for that very disturbing trend is the growth of the sort of Walmart economic model. Because you watch what happens when Walmart comes into a community, and as it has grown across the country, it's really destroyed these key pillars of the American middle class. One consists of small business owners. We've lost tens of thousands of independent businesses, often family-supporting businesses, businesses that offer jobs in our communities. And the other pillar of the American middle class that's really been hurt by these companies are manufacturing workers. You know, we've lost about 3 million manufacturing jobs since 1990. And a lot of those jobs have gone overseas because of pressure by these big retail companies. You know, a few years ago, Home Depot and Lowe's went to Black & Decker, the toolmaker, and they said, either you take your manufacturing to a low-wage country and figure out how to make your tools more cheap, or we're going to take you off our shelves. And now Home Depot and Lowe's are about half of the market. So, you know, Black & Decker did what many companies have done in that position. They laid off about 4,000 U.S. workers and moved elsewhere. Getting a good job, production job, union wage job, or starting a small business have been really key ways that generations of Americans have pulled themselves into the middle class, and those avenues are really being cut off. And meanwhile, all of these companies give us in return are very low-wage jobs working in their stores.
And I'm not going to name a name of a big box store, but today I told somebody that I was reading your book, and he said that he needed a little staple, some home remodeling job he was doing, and he went to a big box store, and the young guy had no clue. He tried to describe what he was looking for. The young guy didn't understand what he was looking for. He tried somebody else, and he finally did find it himself by accident, but he knows and he would have to buy a large quantity of them. And he contrasted that with going to our local downtown hardware store, where if he needed two screws, that's all he had to buy. He bought the two screws that he needed. He wouldn't have to buy a whole box of them. Plus, the employee there would know exactly what he was trying to describe and would understand what he needed. And he understood the point that you are making about the interest, the level of interest and concern that you would get from an independent, locally owned business versus the big box store.
I think that's it's such a telling story. I've had so many times where I've gone to my local hardware store where they've explained to me how I don't really need the thing that I think I need. I can get away with something that's cheaper. I don't even need that at all. I mean, I've left actually not buying anything on their advice, and I just think that's wonderful because they really have my interests at heart. I think,
and
he said
he didn't even know what it was he needed. He was trying to describe it to the person. When he described it to me, I said, well, that sounds like a sort of staple. And he said he didn't even know what he was looking for, but he didn't get the help there that he could have gotten.
But they knew, yes. A lot of the argument that I make in the book has to do with community and it has to do with the state of our economy and so forth, why independent businesses are important. But there's another argument in the book, which is sort of purely in terms of our own consumer interest, to think about what's at stake if we let independent businesses go by the wayside. It's an economy that would be much less competitive because we would have a handful of retailers that dominate. But we also lose that passion and expertise that independent business owners bring to what it is that they do. When I was writing the book, I interviewed about 200 independent retailers, toy stores, grocers, hardware store owners all across the country. And when I would talk to them, I would often ask, why did you go into business? Why did you start a bookstore? Why did you start a toy store? And invariably, they would say something about, I needed to make a living. I thought this would be a good way, something about that aspect of it. But they would then also say, I love books. I'm really passionate about childhood development, and I was really interested in toys for that reason. They bring a kind of passion to what they do that's really unmatched by the chains, and an expertise that I think is really quite crucial.
And you were saying that these independent store owners have the interest of their customer and the community at heart. And I find that even if, say, a store manager of a large store does want to do the right thing, the pressures on him are really unconscionable. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that they are sometimes pressured to change time cards of employees to reduce hours?
Yeah.
Isn't that illegal?
It is, but unfortunately the penalties are not such that they have been enough of a deterrent, and this really points to some problems with our laws and our policies in this country. Walmart's been the biggest culprit here, but many of the other big box retailers have been engaged in this too. The store managers are under this enormous pressure to keep their wage, how much they're spending on payroll, down. And there's a number that they have to hit. And it's a number that's really less than what they need to run the store, even just sort of bare minimum. And one of the ways, if they don't meet that number, they can be demoted or even fired. And if they do meet the number, then it means advancement and bonuses that are very important to their salaries. So they're under this huge pressure, and what has happened, and there are now lawsuits in about 40 states, class action lawsuits being brought against Walmart and in some cases other retailers for this practice. They've now been found guilty in quite a number of those states, is that they would just sort of systematically shave off time from people's cards. And of course, these are people who are making already the lowest wages, and the idea that you would cheat someone who is already in that position of being low wage is really, I think, quite severe. The other thing that happens with store managers, to your point about involvement in the community, is that many of these store managers have to work 80 hours a week at the big boxes, and they get moved around. So they may be at one store only for 2 or 3 years, so they don't necessarily have time or stay in the community long enough
to develop a relationship with their consumers.
Yeah, that connection to the place.
In fact, you mentioned, too, that the turnover rate at these large retail stores is as much as 50%.
Right. About half of all the people who start working at a Walmart or a Target in any given year either quit or are fired, within 12 months.
So how can you develop much knowledge of your product or a passion for it or knowledge of your customers if you're only there a short time?
Yeah, well, many of the people, I have to give some credit to these employees who often, really work hard at their jobs and try to do all of those things, but they're just in a position that's really quite terrible, understaffed, underpaid, under constant pressure. You read about some of the working conditions at a place like Walmart. I think one of the more poignant interviews I did in the book was with an employee of a Walmart store in Oregon. And he said to me, he sort of described this sort of psychological environment because they don't want you to think that you're good at your job because then you might be you know, motivated to ask for a raise, to have a sense of self-confidence. And so even though he was one of the more conscientious workers, he really worked hard, he was always sort of getting bad feedback from his managers. And it took him a while to piece together why that was. And I thought, that's extraordinary. You know, what mm-hmm. kind of, you know, business model really is this?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, actually, you had a graphic in your book. You had the size of a football field. And you compared that, because that's a huge space, you compared that with the size of a downtown store, let's say two stories, which mm-hmm. didn't need parking, didn't need a huge paved lot around it, and the size of, say, a Walmart, normal Walmart store, and then the size of a superstore with its parking lot. Mm-hmm. And it was astounding the real estate that that would occupy, which could be forest land, wet land, where rains could soak into the ground instead of running off with the oil and pollutants into the rivers and streams. So I think if people say, well, I support my downtown merchants, I don't shop the big box stores, which I think is pretty difficult to do nowadays, even with the most conscientious person. But we're all affected, even if we try to. So in other words, you make the point in your book that it's more than just consumer choice. We think, okay, we'll just not choose to shop the big box stores, but it's more to it than that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, this is the future of our economies and what has happened. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, these companies just rose to dominance on the basis of consumer choices, that people chose to shop there more often, and that's why these companies have been successful. But that's really only part of the story. The other part of the story is that they have benefited enormously from government help. All of these big retailers get development subsidies. So this is when they go to a town, Target goes to a town and says, we want to build this big store. It's going to create all these economic benefits. You know, never mind if those are really true or not, but they sell that idea to town officials and they say, we're not going to do it unless you give us a $7 million tax break. These chains go around the country. They pick up this money in many of the places that they develop. Walmart alone has taken in over $1 billion in subsidies from local governments in the last few years. Now, if you're an independent business and you go down to City Hall and say, you know, I'd like to expand my store, I'd like to open a second location, can you give me a tax break? I mean, you're going to be laughed out of the room, and they're going to tell you that this is a free market. And, of course, it's not really a free market if your biggest competitors are receiving those kinds of advantages. That's just one level. I document in the book all of these ways in which government has really tilted the playing field. It's quite astounding. And the other aspect of it, too, is that there are, as I said, there are these hidden costs, costs that we pay in one way or another. One you mentioned is the pollution and the land consumption associated with these stores. This is a very fossil fuel intensive development model. I mean, just as you know, intensive fossil fuel wise as you could imagine. So there's a big environmental cost for the rise of these companies. But there's also many other ways in which we pay. Many states have found, for example, that large numbers of big box employees are enrolled in Medicaid and other kinds of public assistance because they don't make enough to get by. And that's a very direct cost that we're paying. Mm-hmm. If they had to internalize some of those costs into their business model, it would really change the dynamics and it would make the competitive playing field a lot fairer for our hometown businesses.
Well, one of the reasons my husband and I consciously chose Chico, was because of its viable downtown. And we wanted that. We wanted the things we needed to get to be within bicycle. No farther than bicycling distance, walking distance or bicycling distance. People can't do that. If they shop at the big box stores, they have to use their car. They can't walk downtown if they're going to. So they have to drive, and that creates expense. And, of course, with the price of gasoline, that I think has been a good thing for us as Americans to force us to take a look at what we're doing and realize, well, maybe I won't drive 5 miles out from town and spend that gas to save 25 cents on a product. And you bring out the point, too, that often those lower prices are an illusion as well, because there might be a low price on a particular item, but not all throughout the store.
They're very clever with their loss leaders. The psychology of pricing and merchandising in these stores is very sophisticated. And so you walk in and they've got, you know, items strategically placed that are very low. I mean, they may be losing money on those items. and which gets you, it reinforces that idea that these guys always beat local retailers on price. But in fact, there have been studies by Consumer Reports and others that have found that in certain categories, independent dealers are actually quite competitive. So it's,
in fact, sometimes it surprised them.
Yes.
When you would give them the research information, they would be surprised.
Yeah, even independent retailers have so bought into this notion that they're sometimes surprised to discover that their prices, if you look across a broad spectrum of goods, are actually, you know, right up there, and sometimes even in certain cases cheaper. So that's really worth looking at. You know, Barnes & Noble and Borders, the two big book chains, which now capture about half of all bookstore spending, when they were growing great guns in the 1990s and building, coming into communities and sort of introducing their model all across the country, they discounted a lot of the books in the store. And it was really difficult for independent booksellers. Right around 2000, once they had eliminated about 3,000 independent bookstores across the country, once they had gained a dominant share of the market and became the only booksellers in many communities, those discounts, you know, quietly disappeared. Now there's a sort of handful of bestsellers that they offer a modest discount on. But for many shoppers, you know, independent bookstores often offer these, you know, frequent buyer clubs and other ways that are actually make them the cheaper choice. But we, you know, many people I talk to are still sort of in that mindset that, oh, well, the, you know, Borders, they discount a lot. But in fact, that hasn't been true for years, not since they gained that kind of market share. I wanted to just say, you know, it's been interesting. I went on a little tour of downtown Chico just now today, and you know, it's really, you have a lot of remarkable assets, as you said, in terms of the hardware store and the bookstore, the number of clothing retailers. It's really quite vital, and I feel like you're sort of it's sort of a decision making point in terms of whether there is going to be more development in the south end of town. Is there going to be growth in terms of the mall and the big box stores down there? Many communities across the country are deciding now that the sort of costs of that model are coming out, are saying no, you know, that we have enough of that and we want to maintain a balance. We want to have an opportunity in our community for independent businesses. We want that to be a choice that we can all take advantage of. And that means sort of setting some appropriate limits on new development and making sure that you're keeping your downtown economy strong.
You know, one thing I thought was interesting, you ask a teacher, if you need supplies, where do you go? And she says, oh, Staples or Office Depot. And then you said, what about if you want a donation for your school program? And the teacher said, go to an independent businessman. Mm. They get support, the community support from the independent merchant. And they feel like they're getting a good deal, getting a cheaper price to shop elsewhere. And I thought, I wonder if people really, if that dawns on them. Yeah, I go when I want a cheaper price, I'll drive out to a big box store. And when I want to solicit concern for a program for the school, something to support the schools, I turn to the local independent businessman.
Absolutely. I mean, the involvement that you see from local business owners often, is that they are very much invested in the places that they do business, not only financially, but also personally. And their involvement in donating and being engaged in various local organization really exceeds what you see with the chains. Studies have found that local businesses give about four times as much as a percentage of their revenue to charity as do the big boxes, which is, you know, really quite a remarkable difference. But the other thing that I think is important is local businesses in our downtowns in particular play a really crucial role in supporting community life. You know, if you run your errands in a downtown business district or where you're going in and out of local businesses owned by people who maybe know you by name and whose kids go to school with your kids and who have those connections to the community, and you're walking, you're in an environment where you're likely to run into your neighbors or meet new people and sort of engage with other people in your community, that's a really important part of nurturing this sense of connection and engagement that people have. And unfortunately, lots of the country now has, you know, that's no longer, those kinds of public spaces no longer exist. You know, people do their shopping in these massive regional big box power centers, as the industry calls them, you know, places that don't have sidewalks, that don't support that kind of interaction, where you're very much isolated and you don't necessarily, you know, you're not running into neighbors in these environments. A lot of the time is spent in your car. And that's, you know, that's undermining our sense of community. And studies show people who live in communities that don't have local businesses are much less engaged. They don't go to city council meetings as often. They don't belong to neighborhood organizations. They actually even vote less than people who live in communities that have lots of local businesses.
Well, you mentioned bookstores, and since this is a book show, I'm particularly interested in your chapter about bookstores and what you had to say about them. Local bookstores that can make their own choices about what books to put on their shelves. And that, I think people don't realize how much they are, if I want to say, at the mercy of large publishers and large bookstores. In fact, I wondered, how did you get a book like this published, Stacy?
You know, it wasn't that easy. It's funny when I...
Because you're biting the hand that feeds you if you're insulting the publishers.
Yes, that's very true. And in fact, I was quite, you know, when I got an agent and I wrote the proposal and she started sending it out and I said, you know, I think we probably should go with a small independent publisher given the nature of the book. And she said, well, let's send it out broadly and see who's interested and we'll go from there. So she mailed it out to big publishing houses and so forth. And I was actually quite surprised because she got emails from more than one of these publishing houses who said, you know, this looks like a very interesting book. It's an important topic. But we can't touch this because it's critical of our two biggest customers, Barnes & Noble and Borders. And I was surprised that they would actually even come right out and say it.
And say that, admit it.
Right. Mm-hmm. I thought they'd just say, oh, we didn't like it or, you know, some other excuse. Uh-huh. But there it was. But fortunately, Beacon Press, which is a wonderful 150-year-old independent publisher in Boston, took on the book, and they knew that they could sort of build support for it at independent bookstores, and fortunately, independent booksellers have really helped to get this out there into the world.
Well, let me give the title again. Stacy Mitchell's book is Big Box Swindle: The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. And she admits that she is critical of the way publishers operate, and you have to give them credit for admitting that they would be insulting their two biggest customers to publish your book.
Yes. Well, I think many publishers are probably feeling a little concerned about how narrow the market has become. I mean, it's not good to have just three companies really that dominate book sales. You throw in Amazon too. I mean, that's mm-hmm. just not mm-hmm. that's not a competitive market, and in the long run, I think really hurts everyone.
And especially the new novelist or novels in particular, but that you call mm-hmm. it the mid-list, not the big name writers who get the big advances earn the big bucks, so to speak. But the unknowns that mm-hmm. Can't get their name out there.
Yeah.
Unless they have the help of an independent bookstore, because the larger bookstores can't carry. They get their list, they're told what books they can put on their shelves.
Well, yes, and so much of that real estate's so expensive. You know, I mean, most people don't realize, but those tables, you know, when you walk into Barnes & Noble and you see those tables with the books at the front, that's most of what customers at those stores look at and end up buying. You know, that's the where people's attention is focused. Those tables are very expensive real estate. I mean, publishers
I think that would surprise people.
To have books there. And it's also true of Amazon. I mean, if you have a book featured on one of their front, you know, one of their key pages, publisher is paying to have it there. And, you know, what that means is that a publisher is not going to put that kind of money up to take a risk on some unknown writer, even if it's a good book. If it's not something they really feel they know is going to sell, it doesn't have a big name or something like that, they just can't afford, they feel like, to buy that kind of exposure for that book. And so what we get is this narrowing where more and more of what's actually bought and read are the big bestsellers and the big names, and all of these new authors are not getting that chance unless they get discovered, you know, by independent bookstores. Unfortunately, there's still enough.
And then the big stores will buy their books.
Exactly.
And put them on the shelves.
Yeah. Exactly. I spoke to many authors. Barbara King-Solver was one who said to me, you know, I owe my career to independent booksellers. She said, I don't know, you know, in a world where it was just big chains and Amazon, I don't know that my first book would have ever really seen the light of day, because it was independent bookstores who sort of discovered it and through word of mouth really built that interest in it.
Did you talk to John Grisham?
I didn't, but I talked to a bookseller in Mississippi who had been instrumental in John Grisham's first success. There were really four or five independent bookstores in the South, and John apparently would go around his station wagon with books in the back to supply these stores. And that's how it got going. And, you know, in a corporate world, you know, he would have been an unknown, and who knows if he would have been able to find a way in.
Mm-hmm. And so now he shows his appreciation by, when he makes an appearance at a bookstore, it's these independent bookstores that he goes to.
Yes, absolutely.
you say that your publisher is in Boston, and I thought it was interesting you tell the story of the Boston Tea Party from a slightly different perspective than we usually hear it. We usually hear the story as, well, rah-rah, we told we're not going to pay the tax on tea, and it appears that we are rebelling against King George III. But what else were the colonists rebelling against?
And when our forefathers and mothers not dumped 90,000 pounds of tea into Boston Harbor, yeah, you know, we miss the other part of the story in our school history books, which is, you know, it was actually more an act of defiance against the East India Tea Company, which at the time was this global corporate powerhouse, very much the Walmart of its day. The East India Company had actually was struggling and was not making the kind of profit that it wanted to at that time. And so it, much as Walmart goes to local governments for handouts, the East India Company went to British Parliament and got them to enact this tax on the local tea merchants across the colonies. So if you were a local merchant here in the colonies, your tea had to be taxed, whereas the East India Company was able to come in tax-free. And they thought, you know, the lure of cheap tea will undercut any sense of loyalty.
That's what the British were thinking now.
Yes, that's what the East India Company was thinking. Well, we'll win out because we've got cheap tea. And even if people feel this loyalty to their local merchants, they'll still buy from us. Well, it didn't turn out that way. And colonists, of course, dumped the tea into the harbor. And homegrown and homespun became, you know, the fashion of the day. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Well, I think you're hoping that history will repeat itself and that people will rally. In fact, you cite instances where people did rally.
Oh,
not
yes.
always successfully. The case in Mexico where Costco was going to build they were going to tear down an historic hotel and casino and build a Costco. But and you know, when I was reading the story, I thought, oh, good, with all these people rallying to support keeping their historic hotel, that they're going to win. But they didn't. Costco won.
Well, you know, I think we've spent a lot of time talking about the problems and what the costs have been to this, but there's actually just a really good news out there,
what I wanted
yeah.
just to get
and
to.
Yeah, and the whole second part of the book is about that. And over the last few years, hundreds of communities have said no to big box development. In the last year alone, Walmart has pulled out of 70 locations because of community opposition. More and more places are sort of waking up to what these costs are and are putting in place planning policies that limit large-scale retail development and really support small local businesses and downtowns. That's a huge turn of events. The other thing that we've seen in the last couple of years is that there's actually started to be an uptick in the number of new independent businesses. You know, in the 90s, you could count on one hand the number of new independent bookstores that opened in a given year. The last 3 years, we've had 300 new independent bookstores open nationwide. We've got new hardware stores. We've got new greengrocers. New toy stores. You know, independent businesses are by no means out of the woods, but something is changing out there, and I'm hoping that it's the beginnings of a larger sea change in our priorities as a society. And there are growing numbers of buy local campaigns now across the country where independent businesses get together and sort of put out some of this educational material about what's at stake here and how much further your dollar goes if you spend it at a local business in terms of the benefit to your community and the local economy. And those campaigns, have been in the places where they've been going for a few years have been successful. There's documented evidence that they're actually shifting people's shopping patterns. And what we're also seeing anecdotally is a lot of new businesses are starting up in those communities because they say this is a great place to be. There's really support for local businesses here.
The book we're talking about is Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses. The author is Stacy Mitchell. And Stacy, thank you so much for writing this book.
Thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.